I'm Sarah Marshall. I've worked with some of the world's leading brands to drive business growth. And now I'm sharing my knowledge and expertise with you. In my podcast, Lessons from the Boardroom, I talk to other successful leaders to find out how they've perfected their craft, driven success, and dealt with the challenges that leadership brings. So come on, dive in. Welcome to Lessons from the Boardroom, the podcast version. And today, you're not going to believe who I've got because it is the Richard Moore. I love that your email is the Richard Moore, by the way.
I have a disclaimer on that. I tried to buy richardmoore.com, but it's a chap in South Africa who's a photographer who never uses his website. And I'm like, how much do you want for it? And he was like, no, I think I'll just keep it. So I'm now the definite article as being the Richard Moore. And it's, yeah, it's a little full of it, but why not? I've been like this for about 10 years. So yes, thank you so much.
Assume the position. We have the Richard Moore with us, the Richard Moore, founder of The Art of Sell. And guru doesn't even cut it.
Thank you.
Superstar of LinkedIn sales and conversion. I've worked with Richard in his accelerator program, which is also fabulous, but he's moving on to, not moving on.
Addition of
bigger and better things. Welcome, Richard. It is lovely to have you here today.
Always a pleasure to hang out with you. And thank you. It's a really warm welcome. So much to talk about. So I'm really excited. Thank you.
I was just like, look at my smile. It's because like listeners wouldn't know, but we've just had 30 minutes just talking stuff.
And we can't help ourselves. Yes.
It's a happy day. It's a good day. Okay, right. We're going to get into this. So Lessons from the Boardroom is all about sharing what we've learned in our leadership journeys with others that are on the same path. We just have some very basic questions. But first, can you give us a flavour of your history, your past, how you've got to where you are today, why you're so fabulous?
Well, that bit I will do my best with. So thank you. Let me try and keep this swift. So my past, I'll start at university because I think it's really important to give that context. So I failed my A-levels after being straight A student at GCSEs.
What did
I messed
you do?
Them up because I was in my head about anxiety and delivery and couldn't do it and all that kind of thing. And it really sets the scene here because it made me a very nervous person at that age. I had an older sister who was straight A's and went to Oxford, and it was big shoes to fill. And so after all these A's and everyone thinking great things of me, I got in my head. I was doing my A-level exams. And at one point I had to leave because I was about to throw up with so much anxiety. So I completely failed. And I scraped in through clearing in 1999 to Northampton University, bless it, had just become a university. And I did a history degree. But my thing was like, look, come on, I'm bigger than this. I can do more. And with all love and respect to that wonderful university, I was like, I need almost a vanity degree to prove that this isn't the level I'm at. So I then paid through the nose with a bank loan and did a master's in history at Warwick after
there
that. So that people had the reaction you just have. And so I could have some form of parity with my older sister. I was very competitive with her at the time. And what's interesting is that I then fell in love with academia and with learning. And like, I was one of those students that was romantic about being in the library late, unsurprisingly surrounded by books and like learning and going to adjacent topics and things.
Did you wear top hat and tails whilst you were in the library?
It was like, I might as well have been. It was, the problem was it was built in the 60s, Warwick, but it was one of those ones where learning didn't, I moved from being a student to becoming like this peer with these PhD students and researchers, and the people whose books I'd read in my undergrad were the ones who are now teaching me. I was in their studies with them, and we got to, you know, it was a lot of red wine at 2 in the afternoon, Sarah, and it was really good fun doing it.
Smoking jackets.
Yeah, it was a lot. Yeah, it was a lot of elbow patches. And so it was that kind of thing. And the reason why I bring this up is because I fell in love with it so much. I then had designs on doing a PhD and being one of those people who had like a flea-bitten, cardigan and was writing papers all the time. So I applied for a PhD, didn't get funding. And so I had to get a job. And one of the most powerful things at that point was my very strict mother, who I love very dearly for pushing me, said, just so you know, this is a quote, just so you know, you're not coming home. And I'm like, wow, good way to push me out the nest. She's like, well, obviously, if you had to, but like, come on, go and get a job then. So I interviewed the first job I applied for. This is not a LinkedIn post, because a LinkedIn post would be I failed 100 times to get a job. The
Dot
first
dot
job I
dot.
exactly the first job I applied for, I got, which was selling internet marketing in 2003, cold calling. And so,
Oh.
yeah, and so I was like, imagine the person I was, and I'm like, wow, okay, so I have to be this obnoxious, swaggery kind of, if you can imagine the Wolf of Wall Street minus the midgets and the strippers, but like that boiler room kind of vibe.
Disappointing.
It was awful. It was like, and it was literally like that. We weren't allowed to sit down. It was like we were like in there like battery hens, and our job was to beat the phone all day long. In hindsight, it's like what a skill set, because my mum again was in my head like, you don't get to quit. And I remember like at one point going, I've got no money, I can't do it. And she's like, well, so are you saying it can't be done? And so I was like, well, no, because people are doing well, so go crack the code. And so what happened was I pushed myself, and within about a year and a half, I started really getting it and became a team lead. And then I went through a number of iterations and selling virtual conferences. And then I was promoted to a head of sales of our proper physical conference arm, and went through the 2000s kind of growing up. Then I was headhunted into an executive search company in the late 2000s and became a sales director. So I have a lot of lessons from the boardroom, but from that perspective, and there were some really interesting conversations that start happening at that kind of level. But then in 2012, I had a series of big family things happen to me. So at the start of the year, my very, very dear grandmother passed away, and she was really one of those grandmothers who I would spend a huge amount of time with, like really warm. And like we talked earlier about being in the apex of the family. And so she passed away. And then later that year, in August, my daughter was born without an esophagus. She had to have surgery straight away and was put in like induced coma for 2 weeks.
Oh,
And
Richard.
so I didn't get to hold my own daughter. Like we lived in Addenbrookes Brooks in Cambridge, in this kind of center of excellence. And
Thank
I
you,
was in,
Adam Brooks.
oh, well, amazing hospital and university. And I was then all the way down to London to try and work. And then at the end of that same year, so 3 months later, my mother passed away from cancer. So it was possibly the worst year. I mean, one of those things is enough, you know? So I was trying to make my work work. And I had a very, very wonderful managing director who, you know, was like, we will build you a role, whatever it needs to look like, and it can take the time it needs to take. But what happened, this is so crucial, because it was like a real crossroads for me, because it started giving me in 2013 this real perspective on what I was doing. So I was working 80-hour weeks in the city. I would call home to my wife some days and say, I'm just going to stay overnight. There's like a travel lodge around the corner from the hotel. Sorry, from the office, because I started getting this weird logic that if I just worked harder, everything will be okay. So there's no rags to riches story, because I was actually doing really well on paper. I had tailored suits, I had nice watches, I had a six-figure job. I worked as a great in a great role in the city. And so to the outside, I was like, this guy's got it all. But like, I had a grave, and my face was gray, Sarah. I had like yellow eyes.
Sunken eyes.
Yeah. And it's
I
like,
remember it.
you know, I was like 31, 32. And it's like, what are you, is this it for 30 years then? So at the beginning of 2014, as I walked in the door of the office, the managing director was like, Happy New Year, welcome, come straight in my office. I want to talk about the year ahead. And I said, about that, I'm quitting, I'm not doing it. And my wife and I had big conversations about what I could do. And it was like, what are you going to do? Like, you have to find money in that. And even people really close to me were saying, that's irresponsible. You're a dad now. Your lawyer wife is no longer a lawyer wife. She's looking after your kid. You've got a mortgage, you've got a car, you've got all the bills. And I had to find in this world, this like pile of shit, I had to find the backing in myself to be like, one thing I can do is sell. I've got to just make that happen, because I need to be okay in myself. And I was imploding. Like I won't go further into it, but very dark thoughts in 2013, like when it's in a bad place. So my wife was the one who was like, why don't you just go for it? Like, why don't you do something? You like, just find a way, and I'm sure you will, because you love thriving in the pressure and you can manage yourself through it. So I started two Taekwondo academies as well as a consultancy, because I was a black belt fourth dan in Taekwondo, and I'd been training and instructing in the city for a while, in Wembley for a while. And then I was just like, actually, Taekwondo is like a fun hobby. I don't want that to be my business. And I'm loving this consultancy. And the first job I got, Sarah, in the beginning of 2014 was the company I'd left. And my friend who worked for the company I'd left to go there heard I was on the market and said, would you come here and do some work as well? So I picked up some work straight away, and I just fell in love with teaching, which is kind of what was going to happen anyway. It's just under a different guise. And so what happened, what in short, the following decade until today was about 3 years of finding people on Facebook, interacting with them with content. And you've got to remember, coming from a world of cold calling where no one wants to hear from you, trying to get through to a decision maker, to speaking on social media to small business owners who are struggling with closing. I was like, this is ridiculous how easy this is, because they want to speak to me and they are like wearing on their sleeve that they're struggling. And so I just started picking up these online coaching gigs. And then so I did that for a little bit. And then in 2017, I remember August 2017, LinkedIn was like, we're allowing video now. And so I started watching. I was like, something's going on here. This is really good. And of course, contextually, it was business rather than Facebook. So I was fighting with people's wedding photos to try and get through to people. So I pivoted out January 2018. I started posting on LinkedIn, and it's now 2024. And it's just been amazing. This LinkedIn has been a rocket, because the context is all there. And it's afforded me the space to be a student in the way I wanted to. And so I can really geek out. You talked about guru earlier. I love just being a super nerd for the thing I'm into. And it's become all of the periphery subjects, not just selling. It's been the art of the psychology and buyer behavior and all of the deep nuance that people overlook. And I love that I'm able to help business owners learn how to convert without trying to get huge volume or massive amounts of followers, but instead learning like what it means to interact with an individual effectively and get them to see you in the right way and then feel the compulsion to want to buy from you. And so it's, in hindsight, it all makes sense, doesn't it? But when you're doing it, it's like the whole journey's been one hell of a muddle, but it's just so nice to arrive at a place where, you know, as of several years back, I really like the world I've designed, and it continues to be my therapy, building this kind of thing for myself. And all of that has culminated in this moment now, when I'm on a podcast with you.
But regardless of the podcast with me, I agree that it seems to be, this moment is yours. So you've got the brilliant accelerator program with amazingly successful people in there. You've got a fabulous new community that is attracting people like a bloody magnet.
Yes.
Because of you, right?
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
It's true. It's true. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. It's true.
It's true. It is true. It's weird to think.
You know,
yeah, and I think, but the crucial part is I never chased follow account. Never. It's taken me 7 years to still not be at 100,000 followers, which is considered a reasonable amount on LinkedIn, but like, it's just not on the agenda.
Well, we've had this. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
We've had this conversation about volume and value, haven't we? And you talk about this a lot. So do I. You don't need a massive volume. You need the right people with the right value.
Precisely.
So you've got nearly 100,000 people with the right value.
Yeah. And so like, the way to look at it is volume is there at the start to compensate for a lack of ability.
Yes.
When I started selling in 2003, I was tasked with doing 100 dials a day to get 4 pitches. Like that's a terrible percentage, but that's what it is to get 4 pitches. And usually it would be 2, maybe 3 you'd actually get. 4 was like, job well done today. And it would spit out at the end of the week, 1 deal. And our rate card price was £3,400 of in from internet marketing for the year. And like people were like, I don't know. So there was discounts. Like my first sale was a €1,700, dragging them over the line. Like, and so this is what's laughable about, and I call it the mainstream narrative. If you look at LinkedIn, but also social media in general, the gurus on how to build a business are actually teaching how to build a perceived popularity. And so the view, the what's being peddled, I'm going to use that word deliberately, is big numbers are good numbers. And if you have lots of followers, then look, you must be credible. And what's sad is that we've moved to a world where the assumption is if you've got a lot of following or a lot of people are engaging with you, then that means you're proportionately better than anyone else. And that's true for those who teach how to grow on LinkedIn, for instance. But it's unfair because it's not true for those who are incredibly talented but have a small following. It's not proportionate to talent. But the key part here is if you can learn how to be good, be better at the conversion part, you end up not needing to muck around online all day because you have a few people approaching you that are the right people. You have a few conversations a week. And like, it's funny how follower count and impression count really don't seem to matter anymore when you're making hundreds of thousands of quid every year. It's just really interesting how that changes your view on things. So I've kind of taught myself to be a little bit in disgust, I'm going to say, about that narrative, because the truth is that it's a shallow compensation for not learning how to close. And if we just put a bit more of our effort or deployed it away from content and how well we're doing in our content's reach into daring to interact with individuals each day, we'd all be far better off and a lot less miserable for some, in fact. So that's my crusade, as you can sense.
Well, I'm on your crusade. You know, I'm on your
You
crusade. Yeah, I'm
are.
there. So that's kind of your point of view in terms of LinkedIn and the numbers. And I know, and all of my listeners will know how good you are at that. But let's take just a step back and look at where you've got to in terms of leading your business. So not other people and their conversion, your business. So we just said, you know, you are at the peak. Well, probably not knowing you, there'll be another bloody peak, won't
There
there?
certainly are lots of
But
peaks.
you are experiencing several peaks.
Yes.
As a leader of your business, tell me what's the best lesson that you've learned along that journey?
The best lesson there's so many, I'm bottlenecking, Sarah, but probably the best lesson
Give
is
us all of them.
okay. So I would say the best lesson is that we think on the way up, in like as we're starting to grow, we think the holy grail is money. But when you get like your first 50 grand month, and when you hit like half a million, and it's a lifestyle business because it's just you and a little team, you're like, it's not money, it's flexibility. Now it's really apparent that that's the case when you're a dad. So I'm a full tilt girl dad. Okay, so like I love spending time with them. I've never missed a play at school or anything like that. And my wife and I have like raise them 50-50. Like there's no like girl jobs and apart from the
Blue
bins.
jobs, pink jobs.
No, but what's so important is being flexible so that I can be like, I need to drop this and go and do that thing, or I need to be present to do this thing. And what's sad is I know some people who have to reintroduce themselves almost to their children at the weekend, or are pinned with like, oh, I've got to work. And of course there's intensity at times. I can't, like my daughter earlier was like, would you like to play? I'm like, kind of can't today because I need to work for this period. But I'm always like, I can go and do a thing if I have to. And so being present and being able to design what your world looks like and flexibility is actually the holy grail. Like on Friday, I'm having a flying lesson in the morning rather than, well, I've got to go to an office and work and things like that. And that's the best part, is so when you realize that you can do that, it's liberation. And the ticket you have to buy is enough money to be able to survive. Because when you've got enough money to be able to survive, you now have the power. You don't have to take on more business. You can, But you can also choose to do other things as well. This isn't about laying around doing nothing or being lazy. It's just about recognizing that there's some things in the world that you won't get to do when you're old and grey. So doing it now and like being part of it, as opposed to as being a spectator from your desk, you know? So that's one big one. I think what's interesting though is there's a secondary lesson I really wanted to add, which one of the best lessons that I learned for business, but I learned it from my mother. And it was so she had cancer for 2 years before she passed away. And it was like she had true parenting. She never, and I genuinely can't remember her ever complaining. She just didn't complain. She was like, I bet she did to like her brother and sister, but she didn't to me and to my sisters. And so what's interesting is it's like when she passed away, it just gave me that real perspective of like, look how lucky I am that I don't have to go through it. She was just about to touch retirement and she was 60 and that was it. And so just consider what you could lose. And then it just gives you this interesting perspective. You look around, you like, look at the stuff that people complain about. And it just gives you this far better view of the world. And so I took that into work, especially around at the time when she passed away. And it was just like, I've got a lot to like this going for me. And so don't use excuses to or things to complain about to get pity to be able to try and grow in life. It's far better to say, well, I need to find an outlet for being feeling about crap or about something. But in the main, you probably have a lot less to complain about than you realize. And so that's something I'm trying to pass on to my children as well. But that helped me a lot with choosing my battles in business as well. So that I there's two. Hopefully two good lessons there.
My mum died at 60 of cancer.
Oh, really?
And I would say that she had a, oh no, not she, we had a good death
Yes.
for a similar reason. And I remember texting her. She was in the hospice and she'd been given 3 weeks to live, which of course she didn't get. And I texted her and I think I said something like, how are you doing, mum? Which is a ridiculous question anyway.
Yes.
Text back said, all good. I'm like, fuck.
I know.
Oh, mom, you've been given through, and you say all good, and
Yes.
that was her gift to me, wasn't it?
But it was an acceptance is an amazing thing because it's the person going through it who gets there first, and everyone around them is like, oh my God, it's so grim. And they're like,
It's not fair.
And there was actually a time when I remember in her bedroom when, and she is a perfect example of this. It was like she couldn't get out of bed, and we were paying to have someone live with us to care for her because we were in the city and working. My sisters and I, and I remember she's the one who's dying, and I'm the able-bodied one, and she was giving me comfort. She was like, "Come here." And I was trying to never cry in front of her because I thought she didn't need that as well. And then I did one day, and she was just like, "I'm still your mum, you know." And it was just like, "Oh my God!" But so it's
I
amazing how
know.
acceptance makes you view things differently. And I just think, yeah, there's a lot that can be learned from people who are at that stage where they're like, actually, yeah, it's sad, I'm gonna miss a lot. I won't see my grandchildren grow up and things like that. But what's really important is we do consider, rather than always the things in the future, we consider what we've got going for us. And if this was an endless plateau, this stage of my work, I've really front-loaded my life with a lot of good stuff, and I've done a lot of cool things. And so that should be a good perspective as well. But as, if we can, we should is a kind of a nice mantra for embracing things we could try and do.
I love that. The acceptance thing is absolutely spot on. And I think earlier in your career, in one's career, you're on the treadmill, aren't you? I must. More, more, bigger, bigger, faster,
Yeah,
faster.
definitely.
If I remember when I was at Barclays, I'd be getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning
Yes.
just to be the best, you know, and that
Yes.
is screwed up.
I was, it's working short term, it's very short term. And the thing is, I was like, I'm just going to run through walls. And I was on the way on the train, like, you'd get the first train. I was the same. I'd be like, half four, I'd get up and I'm throwing my suit on. And my wife's like, why? And I'm like, because I can be in the office just that much earlier. I can just get a bit more done. I was being not that productive. It wasn't making much difference. But in my, you know, on the way in on the train, I was listening to like motivational stuff and like going, everything. It was like almost like this Hollywood movie. It was like this was a montage scene of me like pushing through. But of course, it was really damaging. It should have been all in slow motion. But what's so interesting is when you emerge out of that and you reconstruct things in the right way, you realize that people say it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's not. It's not even a marathon. It's the biggest ultra ever that doesn't end until you're done. And so the way to view it is, well, I have to work at a sustainable level. And so it's interesting if you look at LinkedIn, for instance, or you know, as a point of comparison, I've been at it for like 7 years, but then there's people who've whizzed past me in some ways in say 2 years, but then those lights shine bright and then they burn out and they crash and like they have to have time out. And I'm like, I'm just sustain, like I can do this forever. And because you learn to work in a way that recognizes the value of pit stopping and looking after yourself properly. And I just didn't look after myself, which is hilarious given I was the crucial part of everything I was doing. So, a lot more yoga and good food these days, I suppose.
Do you think that acceptance comes with age or a certain level of success or something else? What how do you think that acceptance just suddenly gets into us?
It's a good question, and I think you need a virtuous cycle, so a feedback loop, because burnout either comes or doesn't ever come based on a load of hard work, but with output that you hoped for. And I think what's interesting is my ability to work long hours is met with then really good results, and that makes you feel great. And so the burnout thing, I truly went through burnout in 2013. Not like, oh, I'm a bit tired, I'll call it burnout. It was like really bad. But what's so interesting is that you learn over time based on these feedback loops of like, hey, I'm actually getting good results. And what's interesting is you get some measure of success, then you start realizing, often just by serendipity, that actually that short break helped. Or when I went for that massage, I felt better and now I perform better. And now a fair bit of my bandwidth is deployed into maintaining this bubble of delusion, and I'm calling it that the universe is rigged in my favor. And I genuinely feel I've got this. Like there's a foregone conclusion that I'll be successful. My job's to steer into it. So it's a, you know, we talk about a lot in the past, people talk about, you know, removing things from their life that are toxic or not helpful. And I'm really a big fan of dismantling things and removing things and saying no to stuff, while simultaneously saying yes to the right things. So it's a process as opposed to something that happens suddenly. But when you create a world where people are like, wow, that was really good. And oh my goodness, that worked really well. And thank you so much. It doesn't half help you feel motivated to keep doing that kind of thing. But it all starts with, and I think this is a blind spot for many, it starts with a willingness to go deep into the dark hours and like the silent years of working hard on building something that genuinely has impact from the ground up, not has a thin veneer of, wow, aren't I spectacular, but it's all hot air. For instance, the art of sell isn't like, hey, I'm just doing a community and based on a bit of popularity, I'll get people to join it. And then the churn is outrageous because they're like, it's just not that good. It's genuinely working really hard on getting premium speakers and paying outrageous amount, if you think about the income at the moment, for a team of four around me and five now, in fact, to help build this and make sure it's done at a premium level. And when you give quality to people, then they want to stick around. And it's just about being real about the thing we knew all along, that is, if you do it properly, rather than try and shortcut or spend a lot of effort on making something appear good, but you actually are good at it and you actually give proper value, then you'll get the returns you tend to deserve. And so no one likes that advice because it's like, this is 10
It's
years. Yeah. And I hate it. But a lot of people are like, oh, I wish I could sell like you. I'm like, So go sell for 21 years then. I mean, I'm sure people could do it in a short amount of time, but they can't have my experience in less time. Sorry, that's just how it is. And I like that. That's fair because it means that, I tend to have a lot of answers to a lot of things as long as I've actually done it. And I have a massive amount of respect for people who've been on the pitch and who are winners, as opposed to read a book and who are good at posturing as a winner. And there are some geniuses out there, and there are some real like gems who are rockets and are legitimate, but they're not as prevalent as you realize. And so so when we really learn that, it's like, do you know what? Maybe I should just knuckle down and build something credible. So that's where it all comes from.
Do the hard yards. Tell me about the hardest lesson that you've learned.
One of the managing directors I worked for at the time when my mother passed away, and kind of interesting, a lot of lessons come from there. Echoed in a way what my father said when he and my mother broke up. I remember that morning vividly, despite being only 11. And he was never to be seen for 25 years, my father. And my managing director also gave me a similar bit of advice. And the way my managing director said, because I had two sisters who were really upset. I had a wife who was worried about her husband. I had a daughter to look after, and I had myself and all that. And he said to me, "Heavy hangs the head that wears the crown." And he also said it to me a number of times when it was like me taking on these new roles. And when he kind of made me this sales director in waiting, that I was just touching it and then I left really. But like I had that role for a period where I was overseeing the other he heads of sales and so on. And I remember at times it was like, "Man, this is hard." And he was like, "Yeah, heavy hangs the head that wears the crown." He's like, "You want it all," he said, "I'll give you." And I remember the package. He was like, at the time I wanted a Porsche Cayenne, the big one. He was like, "You got it. And all the money, you got it, no problem, but you have to deliver." And I'm like, "Well, that's reasonable." And it's like, he said, "You've got to understand that they all think you're golden. I know you're going through hell at home." But he says, but like, and then he started telling me about things he'd gone through. And he's like, "Everyone's impressed with the guy with the broad shoulders, or the person with the broad shoulders holding the roof up. They're all impressed, but sometimes there are people in your corner to help you, and other times you've just got to be strong." And it's an interesting bit of advice because a lot of people are like, "No, you mustn't. Sometimes you've got to crumple and allow yourself to go
Be
through.
vulnerable.
Yeah, be vulnerable." But it's like, yeah, but it depends on the stakes. And when the stakes are stacked in a certain way, you have to be strong. And I think it was, and my father was the same. And it was a very old-fashioned view he took at the turn of the 90s when he said to me, I remember he whispered in my ear, "You need to be the man of the house and look after everyone." I'm like, "I'm not the oldest, nor am I the parent," but that's just how he
Where's
worked.
he go?
Yeah, so I was like, "What about my older sister?" But anyway, the point was like he said that too, and there's always an element of like, I want to look after my sisters, and we all looked after each other, for the record. I certainly needed a lot of looking after as well. But I do think that the hardest lesson that changed me radically from the in the two when I was in my 20s to in my 30s was you can't pity your way out of stuff. When something, and this is the way to say it, when something is your responsibility, it's like you have to own it. And so if it's your job to own it, you can't like find an excuse. And so, it's interesting because I look back to my mid-20s and I was an excuse maker. If I couldn't do something, I'd find excuses and I would charm people into thinking, "Oh, do you know what? Give him a break. He presents as working really hard," they'd think. And so like maybe he just needs some time. But actually, I was being evasive and ignoring problems. And actually, when you learn that it's, or when you have the attitude of "it's all on me" as a start point, but are willing to accept help, that's a wonderful place to be because it means it's like if the buck stopped with me. Of course, I can't change everything, but I can influence a lot in the 2 meters around me. And if I can get help for the things for which I'm not that great, it really will prop me up. But the things that are my role, don't drop the ball. Like, come on. And I love that about growing up. And I feel much more resilient now to like the bangs and bruises you get through life, because I just think I definitely own the stuff I need to deliver on, and I show up for it, but with a big asterisk, because I'm choosing carefully the things I'm going to be responsible for instance, in work, and the things I wouldn't be that great at, I'm giving to someone else who is a genius at it. And I think that's a crucial lesson as well. So in that is the lesson, like, it's if you want the big success, good for you, but don't think it's like photo shoots and podcasts all the time. In like not even 1% of it. Most of it is owning the outcome and steering into it. And again, it's the dark hours, and it's like all the little bits. And it's like when I went for a run last night at 9 o'clock, and I ran like it wasn't a big run. I ran like was it like 12K or something like that. But
Not a
it's
big
just
one.
training, and like I didn't post it on Instagram. I don't need people to go, oh wow, you're so great. It's like no one needed to know I did that, but I did it because that's the hard graft that no one needs to know, but you have to do, because that's the stuff that holds the rest up. That's the stuff that makes me feel healthy, that gives me the oomph throughout the day, that helps me sleep, that helps me perform. And you've got to be willing to do hard stuff without people looking. That's a big lesson, to not always look for validation externally, but to do it because it needs to be done. And I think, yeah, I've learned a lot from some really wonderful leaders in that regard. I'm sure you have as well.
Yeah, I think this thing about self-validation, I found that quite hard. So, my corporate career, I had top job. I had one of those jobs that you go, well, what job am I going to do after this job?
Yes.
But then I had all of that validate. My PA had a PA. I had
Right.
a guard. I earned a shit ton of money, all of that. And then I kind of grew and exited my own business. And then I was the boss of the business. And I was pitching against McKinsey and PwC and winning, And then when I kind of moved into just working on my own, that external validation wasn't there.
Yeah.
You have to get to a point where it does come from inside. So yes, you have the resilience. Yes, you have the acceptance that we talked about earlier. Have you heard the expression, it's all right to drop a ball, just make sure it's not the glass one?
Yes,
I love that. I love
yeah.
that because there is something about we have to do so much stuff in our life, but focus on the important
But
thing.
on a daily basis, I deliberately drop balls, because I'm like I was saying to my daughter last night. We were talking about mobile phone use, and I said, right now, I have two one-on-one clients who have sent me messages a few hours ago. Well, I'm not replying to them because right now I'm putting my children to bed. And they'll wait till the morning. And it's like, and that's how it is. And there's so many balls I drop. As long as you're right, as long as you keep the glass ball up, and you need to learn, we all need to learn what one actually is the glass ball.
That's it. And your kid was
Yeah,
a glass ball.
because if I have a call that I can't move, well then fine, I can't play with my kid. Or if I've had a call I've had to reschedule, and I like it's a really not a cool thing. But if I can, if I've got some work to do and it will keep. Go and play with your child. You know what I mean? It's just like you've got to choose wisely. But I think for a lot of people, they're keeping aloft a rubber ball of like, oh, I wonder how my post is done. Thank God it's comparatively the same as yesterday's post. That's the thing that matters. Meanwhile, the glass ball of actual client acquisition, for instance, is hurtling towards the ground. And they'll only realize when it's millimeters off the ground, oh my God, I've got to do that now suddenly, because the rubber ball is easy to keep in the air. So just developing a metaphor is really
I've
important.
given you a gift here with the
Yeah, you
glass.
have. Wonderful. There's a post in there somewhere.
There is
Thank
on a plate. Right.
you.
Tell me the single thing that you would say to somebody who is wanting to build their leadership career in a similar way to you have.
Can you define leadership career? What do you mean then
Well,
by that?
you have plotted and led your career to get yourself to a business that is allowing you all of the things that you've just talked about. So it's allowing
Right.
you the lifestyle that you want. It's allowing you in terms of time, flexibility. So what piece of advice would you give to somebody trying to get to that peak as we talked about earlier?
So this is going to sound cute, but I really think it's a good way. I've kind of come up with it as you was talking. So I just want to define it. So I think probably the best advice is be intentional in the dark.
Oh.
So let me define what I mean by this. Being intentional holistically. So people might think, well, that's really rigid. Like, what about having fun and spontaneity? Yeah, be intentional about allowing yourself to do that when it's right, but own all of your tasks, activities, and interactions with the world. I was up at 5:45 this morning intentionally to go and do stretching, yoga, breath work, and visualization. And I do it every single morning, and that's my morning. When I'm doing that, I'm not checking my phone. And then I have breakfast and I take air in from the garden and I go in, and then my daughter comes down because she has to come down early because we're driving her to school. And I have a routine where I make a breakfast and I've not checked my mobile. And then I take her to school and we talk. And when I get home, I then make myself an incredibly pretentious, snobby coffee. And that's a ritual part of my day. And I'm not checking my phone. And much of, yeah, but much of that schedule or routine is no one seeing it, but I'm being intentional about it. And then in the background, and a nice way for people to do this exercise of being intentional is imagine there's a film crew recording the future Hollywood movie of your life, because there are people listening right now, possibly, who may end up with a Hollywood movie made of their life. Why not? If they do something wonderful, imagine they're filming right now. And there's a line that a coach once gave to me, which is really question mark this question mark. So when you say to yourself, really this, as in the task I'm doing. So when you get your mobile and you're like, you kind of have that urge to check Instagram, by the way, delete it. When you have Instagram, you're like, really this at 10 o'clock in the morning, this is the thing, is it, that's going to take me places. And when you apply that filter for everything, it's so interesting how you drop the crap and you focus on things that matter. And I do it with so many things that it's like, if I'm out for a run and I'm like, I think I might stop at 10K, I'm like, really though? Like, really? No one needs to know I ran further, but could you run further? So run further. And like, always putting that filter on, like, what am I doing? All the way down to the minutiae of how you interact with LinkedIn, for instance, or online in your business. What's your interaction that you're doing right now with the world? Maybe you're typing a comment. Really? This one? You're writing that comment. That's the best you're putting out in the world. Or really to that person? Or really, do I need to write the 400th comment today? Or is there something better I could be doing with my time? And again, you're not needing to report to anyone else. You're
I thought
doing.
about you this weekend. So I was sat there with a knit comb.
Right.
A
I've
knit
been
comb
there.
and a glass of wine. Yeah, but you have not.
Oh, not with your hair. No, with my daughter's. Thank goodness.
So I'm sat there with a knit comb and a glass of wine, and I took a picture and I nearly posted it. And I was thinking, I'll post this because it's funny and
Yeah.
engaging, clickbait almost.
Yeah.
And there you were on my shoulder, not quite saying really.
Yes.
But what you were saying was be the person that people want you to be intentional,
Yes.
and I didn't do it. And
Good,
I'm
good.
sure if I'd have posted a picture of a knit comb and a glass of wine, my engagement would have been through the
It
roof.
would have. It would have. You've
But
got loads of people. Yeah.
it wouldn't have done me any good.
And that's the crucial part. This is the blind spot. You would have possibly gone viral, but the senior decision makers at big corporate X, or company, not X necessarily, who are like watching, they're not going to go, oh my God, she's the one.
Because
Like,
she's got this.
yeah, it's like they're thinking the opposite. They're like, what's wrong with this person? Oh, it's another one of those also rans who's desperate for attention. So it's crazy that we think that any attention is good attention. That's a saying in marketing, but truthfully, when you remove volume, you focus on the right people seeing you in the right way, and that's all that matters. So always, like, what am I putting out there? Why am I writing this? And people think that takes a lot of the soul from it. No, it's about focus. And I think, wasn't it Serena Williams, who may have been quoting someone else? I think she probably was quoting a philosopher when she said something like, discipline is liberation. Because if you stick, if you like, and I love that every day I'm like really intentional about the things I do, rather than just like, Oh, what could I scroll through today? And being led by the world, I'm being led by myself. It is liberation because then you get stuff done and then you can move up. And it's stunning how some people 10 years ago who are still connected with me from, say, Facebook, haven't moved the needle at all because they're led by what stimuli come to them as opposed to choosing how they deploy their very valuable time. Which is why, and I'm going to add a question here you could have asked me, which is what's the most important book on the planet? The most important book everyone should read is On the Shortness of Life by Seneca. When I first read it, if you read it and you really get it, you're like, I remember putting it down, going like, what am I doing with my time? Oh my God, you realize how time is so important. You need to use it in the right way. If anyone's not read it, it's like a pamphlet. It's like 60 pages. It's the most important realization. And then there's that saying, isn't there? I can't remember if it's Aquinas or someone who said, they said a man, but they mean a person has two lives. And the second one starts when they realize they only have one.
Absolutely
That's powerful.
spot on. And I think, in a way, tragically, that because we both lost our mums at 60, that for me, I mean, that's when things started to change. I was like, why am I doing this? What? Why am I? This is ridiculous.
Such a gift, and I've
Yeah,
like
a gift.
turning it into a gift. Otherwise, it's like bloody hell, that was horrible, and of course it was. But the gift was the resilience, and the gift was the perspective, and that matters so much. So I miss her dearly, and I would give so much to see her for an hour. But at the same time, like that's a bigger gift than anyone could have ever given. So I thank you for letting me share that.
No, I appreciate you and your time. It's been lovely. Tell me, last thing, what's next for Richard Moore?
What's next, Richard Moore? I'm in my world or in my business world, because I've got too many things. I think in my world, it's absolutely continuing to love the construction of Art of Sell. I'm obsessed in the most beautiful way with it, and I'm enjoying. There's so many fun things we get to do, and the thing is, I know it will work. Because I won't quit on it, and we're like it's messy in the background, but we're making it happen, and I'm excited about where it goes, and like the numbers stack up, and I've even had an investor going, I'm watching, by the way, so it's kind of exciting, but I can't wait for where it will be, but I'm loving this process, and for me personally, I'm working on my pilot's license and an ultra, so they're my two like personal projects at the same time, so. I think it's just nice to have some ambitious goals in front of you that you know there's a path to achieving as long as you're willing to go through some hard stuff. And I run at hard stuff. I do enjoy that.
You run at walls. Well,
Yes.
this has been an absolute joy. Honestly, I've just sat here with a smile on my face the whole time. I've loved this session. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And I will see you in my accelerator program shortly.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing, and I feel like we could do a several more hours on this. But I think the big takeaway, isn't it, is like everything we think is business is often rooted in our personal lives, and that's what gives us a lot of direction.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.